want to get to the point where you can have a stable economy that doesn't ride the boom and bust cycles of the oil markets.
The Walker administration proposes a new way to fund state government from the Alaska Public Radio Network. This is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, October 28th. Good evening, I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, lawmakers debate whether the state should stick with TransCanada.
TransCanada was willing to put up its share of that upfront money, and the state has not exactly been rolling in cash the last few years.
Tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Learn more about Alaska Pacific University during a 3-day weekend experience October 30th to November 1st. Experience the campus and Anchorage while discovering how APU can map out your educational adventure by attending courses, participating in activities, and interacting with faculty and other students. Register at alaskapacific.edu. This message sponsored by APU.
Governor Bill Walker will propose overhauling the way Alaska uses the permanent fund when he releases his budget later this year. The plan would turn the state's various savings accounts into a kind of endowment, using their earnings to fund state operations. The administration is comparing the idea to the sovereign wealth funds used in oil-dependent states like Norway. Talking with reporters this morning, Attorney General Craig Richards said the goal is to stabilize state finances in the face of wild swings in oil prices.
You want to get to the point where you can have a stable economy that doesn't ride the boom and bust cycles of the oil markets.
Right now, the state's budget for day-to-day operations relies largely on revenue from oil taxes, and the drop in oil prices has created a deficit of about $3 billion. The governor's plan would send oil taxes into the permanent fund instead. Walker's team believes it can then pull about $3.3 billion a year from the fund's earnings reserve without depleting the fund itself. The plan would allow the state to avoid drastic cuts in services, though in its current form, it would likely also reduce permanent fund dividend checks. Richards stressed that the changes should be made as soon as possible, preferably during the regular legislative session this spring.
If we take a couple of years and do this, we're burning down our assets. We're spending the money we need to make the sovereign wealth model work. So if you don't get this in place pretty quickly, it's going to have to look different and a lot less effective.
The proposal would also change the way dividends are distributed. Instead of coming out of permanent fund earnings on the stock market, dividends would be pulled directly from state oil and gas royalties. Richards estimated that under this system, next year's PFD would be about $1,000. Richards said the changes could be accomplished through legislation without the need for any constitutional amendments. Many lawmakers were open to the idea. Senate President Kevin Meyer, an Anchorage Republican, called the proposal a good first start. He said it resembles a Senate bill introduced this spring, though the Senate version would devote more revenue to dividends.
Absolutely. This concept, one of our bills, combination of his concept and our Senate Bill 114, is very doable as long as we get cooperation from the governor, the minority, in getting the budget reductions that we want to get.
Minority Leader Chris Tuck, an Anchorage Democrat, says in general he likes the endowment concept but needs more details on this particular plan. And then he says the governor has to convince Alaskans.
The concern, of course, is using the permanent fund to pay for government services, which may not be that popular.
The administration stressed that the plan right now is in draft form and subject to revision. The final version will be included in the governor's formal budget proposal this winter. In Juneau this week, lawmakers are wrestling with the question of whether to take a larger stake in the Alaska LNG gas line project. Specifically, they must decide whether to buy out one of the state's partners, TransCanada. That's a key priority for Governor Bill Walker, and during testimony today, a representative from TransCanada spoke in favor of the buyout, saying the state's interests and the companies have diverged over the course of the project. But the buyout would put the state on the hook for as much as $7 billion more in construction costs, APRN's Rachel Waldholtz reports.
Before we get into whether or not it's a good idea to buy out TransCanada, let's back up and remember how we got here. Specifically, let's head back in time to the era of Governor Sarah Palin.
And now it's time for a new generation of energy for Alaska. It's time for our gas line.
Palin signed the Alaska Gas Line Inducement Act, or AGIA, to try to jumpstart work on a gas line. Basically, the state put up to $500 million on the table to help develop a natural gas pipeline from the North Slope to the Lower 48. The company that won that contract was TransCanada. Fast forward to 2012, and cheap shale gas had swamped the market down south.
It was like betting on the Cubs for the World Series. It was just a loser.
That's Larry Persily, who followed the project as a state and federal official and now advises the Kenai Peninsula Borough. A pipeline through Canada no longer made sense, so the three major producers on the North Slope, ExxonMobil, BP, and ConocoPhillips, proposed a different plan, a pipeline that would export the natural gas to Asia. That was the birth of the Alaska LNG project. But the state was still committed to its partnership with TransCanada. By then, of course, Governor Sarah Palin was out and Governor Sean Parnell was in. His team struck a deal with TransCanada, bringing it in as a partner on the state's 25% share of the new project as a way to get out of the old project.
It was the cost of getting a divorce. And also, I think the state saw TransCanada as an experienced pipeline partner with expertise, with knowledge, with history, and TransCanada was willing to put up its share of that upfront money, and the state has not exactly been rolling in cash the last few years.
That's the deal that now Governor Bill Walker would like to exit. For Walker, it's all about control.
Alaska needs to lead this project. We should be the head of the team. We should be driving this effort.
Right now, the state shares its vote on the project with TransCanada. Walker says that's simply not enough.
It's a must-have for us. It used to be something on someone's wish list in the past, but now it's an absolute must-have because of what it will do for Alaska. So no one is more motivated than we are to make sure that this happens.
The Walker administration also makes a second point. They say buying out TransCanada just makes economic sense. Right now, TransCanada is essentially acting as the state's banker. It's paying the upfront costs for all of the work on the project. But under the current deal, the state must reimburse those costs. If the project falls through, the state will pay back anything TransCanada has spent, plus 7% interest. If the project succeeds, the state will essentially pay those costs as part of its deal to ship gas down the pipeline. Walker and his team think the state could finance the project more cheaply itself, and without a partner, make more money once the gas starts flowing. Many lawmakers agree, but some, especially Republicans, still have questions.
It does sound good that we would be at the table 100%. But this is a $45 billion minimum, $45 billion project.
Anchorage Republican Kathy Geisel is the chair of the Senate Natural Resources Committee. She points out that without TransCanada, the state has to come up with a lot more money up front.
We need to make sure that the state can afford this and what the financing would look like. And so that's what we're digging into right now.
The administration is asking for $158 million to buy out TransCanada's share, cover agency costs, and finish the early planning phase of the project. But the real costs come down the line. If the state buys out TransCanada and the project goes forward, the state's share of construction costs would double to an estimated $14 to $16 billion. Geisel says it might make more sense to let TransCanada face the challenge of coming up with that money, even if it cuts into the state's revenue down the line.
We have health care. We have public safety to deal with. There's education. All of these are calls on the cash that the state has. We have a broader responsibility than simply building a gas pipeline.
Anna McKinnon is co-chair of the Senate Finance Committee. She brought up another issue, expertise. Without TransCanada at the table, do state agencies have the expertise to manage the state's share of the project?
There may be the technical expertise at the state or inside of the project-specific component. There, we need to understand that so that we can make our decision.
Despite these reservations, lawmakers, including McKinnon, seem to be leaning towards approving the buyout. McKinnon says for her, it comes down to a new way of doing business. When the Trans-Alaska Pipeline was built, the state didn't own any of it. This time, the state wants a piece of the pie, with all the risk and reward that entails. From the Energy Desk, I'm Rachel Waltholz in Juneau.
The U.S. House today approved a two-year budget deal that would break through sequestration budget caps and avoid a government debt default. Alaska Congressman Don Young, like a majority of House Republicans, voted no. Young says his primary objection is that the agreement would raise cash by selling off some of the Strategic Petroleum Reserve.
We paid a high price for that oil or a reserve, and they're using it to finance this budget, and they're also using it for transportation. You can't keep taking from the piggy bank. And I'm just saying that it's the wrong way to approach this thing, so I voted no.
The Strategic Petroleum Reserve is stashed in caverns in Texas and Louisiana. It was created in the 1970s to protect against supply disruptions. Lately, though, Congress has been eyeing it as a potential revenue source. Senator Lisa Murkowski hasn't said how she'll vote on the deal when it reaches the Senate, but spokesman Robert Dillon says the draw from the reserves is a big concern for her.
She has consistently taken the position that any SPR sale proceeds should go towards strengthening our nation's energy security.
The budget deal sailed through the House with a 99-vote margin and no Democratic opposition. House Speaker John Boehner said, and his likely replacement, Wisconsin Republican Paul Ryan, both voted for it. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, efforts to revive the Aleut language on St. Paul Island.
It's going to work. We have to make it work. That's our identity of who we are.
Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by First National Bank Alaska, where local knowledge and experience make the difference. We believe in Alaska. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC. And by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
A woman claims that one of the Fairbanks Four had blood-stained shoes from the 1997 assault of John Hartman. In a video deposition played at an ongoing evidentiary hearing in the contested case on Tuesday, Margarita Hoffman says she was there when Marvin Roberts came home hours after Hartman was attacked. In the scratchy recording, Hoffman says she saw blood on his shoes.
You could tell on the shoes where there was a couple stains. Of blood on the shoes.
Hoffman was the girlfriend of Robert's uncle, Kenny Mayo, and says they had been consuming cocaine and alcohol before she observed Roberts arrive home and head into a bedroom to talk to Mayo.
When he came out of the room, he had a pair of tennis shoes, and he says, "We got to get rid of these tennis shoes."
Hoffman says Mayo disposed of the shoes in a nearby dumpster. She says she decided to come forward with the information when Roberts, George Freeze, Kevin Pease, and Eugene Vent, the men convicted of fatally beating Hartman, began pursuing exoneration. Coastal Alaskans say the state ferry system is a necessity, not a luxury. They urged officials to maintain marine highway service as much as possible during a recent meeting based in Sitka that was teleconferenced statewide. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
Joel Jackson lives in Cake, an island village of about 500 in central southeast Alaska. He's among those depending on state ferries to get to doctors and hospitals.
Sometimes that's the only option to get our elders out of the village over to Sitka or Juneau, wherever their medical needs are. And, you know, I personally have assisted my mother and father onto these ferries, you know, to take them to the hospital. And without doing that, I think their lifespan would have been a lot shorter.
Jackson was one of more than 50 people testifying at a meeting hosted by Soldotna State Senator Peter Michicki. He's chairman of the Senate Transportation Committee and oversees his chamber's Marine Highway System budget review. The topic was deep service cuts slated for next summer. The proposed schedule would tie up four ships, including fast ferries serving Southeast and Prince William Sound. Sitka High School Activities Director Lindsay Jorgensen said the reductions will make student travel difficult.
If the ferries get cut to this level, only 20% of our kids would be able to travel for the same budget. That means on a basketball team, one kid could travel out of the five. If we look at music, where we travel 100 kids in the spring, you can't get 100 kids on an airplane.
Several speakers said air travel is too expensive and can't handle what needs to be moved, especially to small communities. Cordova's Jennifer Gibbons says the ferry system is an essential part of her region's economy.
Here in Cordova, that includes supporting the Prince William Sound commercial salmon fishery, which this year, 2015, proved to be the most valuable commercial salmon fishery in the state. And Marine Highway, and in particular the Chinigo, were central to realizing that high dollar value.
The cuts will also affect the military. Callers pointed out that many service members travel to Alaska posts via ferry. Coast Guard spouse Christy Newell says at least 50 service members' families transfer in and out of Sitka each summer. They're moving whole households, including vehicles, kids, and pets.
A drastically reduced summer schedule, it really limits our options of getting here, and we have to get here in a very specific time. And we have to leave to get to our next job in a very specific time.
Others raise the impacts on tourism, especially in smaller port communities. Sitka's Doris Smith summarized many people's concerns that the state is turning its attention away from Alaska's Marine Highway.
Our ferry system is a jewel that needs to be valued and cared for. The ferry system is of utmost importance to the entire population of Southeast Alaska. We need more and better service, not less.
The planned service cuts are due to Alaska's rapidly shrinking revenue stream. Many speakers acknowledge the dire budget situation, but ask that the Marine Highway get equitable treatment. State transportation officials are taking comments on the summer ferry schedule through November 3rd. A statewide hearing will be held November 4th. In Sitka, I'm Ed Schoenfeld.
The state of Alaska has chosen its preferred access route to Gravina Island, but Ketchikan officials are not excited about the choice. Among the options on the table is a bridge known nationally in the past as the Bridge to Nowhere, or the option of improved ferry service. The state opted for the latter, though Department of Transportation Commissioner Mark Lukin says it would not include new ferries or additional ferry service unless demand increases.
Right now, based on our traffic projections that have come through the EIS, we don't see that demand increasing, at least certainly not in the immediate future, maybe not even in the distant future. But again, we will address that when we get to that point.
The option chosen by the state is the cheapest one, estimated to cost about $23 million. Borough Manager Dan Bockhorst pointed out some concerns that the borough has with the choice, particularly with items that will add costs to the borough, which operates the state-owned airport. The community would have to figure out how to pay for a new ferry when the current ones need replacement, and then there's the shuttle vans.
The solution in G4V is to buy two Econoline vans and let the Ketchikan Gateway Borough operate them at a cost of $350,000 a year, which is throwing an anchor around to us while we're treading water.
Bockhorst offered an alternate proposal for DOT to consider, which includes more parking, a new ferry, and additional ferry transfer sites.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to helping people reach their goals on and off the field. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
The University of Alaska Southeast, with schools of arts and sciences, management, education, and career education in Juneau, Ketchikan, and Sitka. UAS, a learning community on campus and online. More at uas.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by UAS.
Sharing Our Knowledge, a conference of Tlingit tribes and clans, starts Thursday morning at Centennial Hall in Juneau. About 400 people are expected to attend. KTOO's Lisa Fu has more.
The Clan Conference is a gathering of elders and academics, tradition bearers, and students. The concept of the event, which started in 1993, came from the late Tlingit scholar Andrew Hope III. Ishmael Hope is his son.
In many ways, there was a power imbalance where our stories were being told, our culture was being talked about, our people were being talked about, and the people had very little control over that. They had very little way to exercise their voice and to share who they really are, you know. And so it was the idea that we come together as equals.
The first Klan conference was in Haines and Klukwan, and the event continued taking place around Southeast Alaska through 1997. It was revived in 2007 and now takes place every 2 years. Hope is looking forward to hearing from the elders.
Our elders have so much of just a vast library of knowledge, things to share, and we still have our elders. I mean, sometimes people talk so much about cultural loss, how much is not there, but I think it's a gift with the elders that we have and what they'll present.
The Klan conference includes 3 days of presentations and seminars. The roughly 40 sessions range in topics from art to ecology. Linguist Alice Taff is one of the event organizers. The conference will feature a plenary session on Thursday, Friday, and Saturday mornings.
The conference theme, Ha Sahu Ha Shletzini, Our Names, Our Strength, that theme will be illuminated by Norma Shorty, who will be talking about finding our names. And Friday morning, Tom Thornton and Harold Martin will be talking about place names. And Saturday morning, there will be an author's panel.
The conference's all-day events include a weaving exhibit, a Native arts market, a viewing of photos from the Cyril George collection, and a chance to listen to Alaska Native educational stories through StoryCorps at your library. Beth Weigel with Juneau Public Libraries says the listening booth will feature excerpts from interviews recorded in Juneau, Haines, and Klukwan. Weigel says Klan conference attendees can also record their own stories alone or with a friend or family member.
It's a great format for passing down stories through the generations and telling people about experiences that they've lived and that they want to share and make sure that that voice stays alive, the sound of that voice, as well as the stories from that person.
The Klan conference also features special events honoring the late Walter Porter, the late Richard Dauenhauer, and a reading of Indigenous literature at the Governor's Mansion. In Juneau, I'm Lisa Fu.
City and tribal employees on Alaska's St. Paul Island get the day off today. It's a holiday you might not have heard of, Aleut Independence Day. It marks the day in 1983 when St. Paul Islanders gained their freedom from the federal government. The U.S. had been running the seal harvest and the economy of their island for decades. A long history of displacement and forced labor has left its mark on Aleut culture. Today, St. Paul Islanders are trying to revive their language and their culture. KUCB's John Ryan reports.
My name is Ethan. I'm in the fourth grade. We stand for the pledge.
At the start of every school day, children at the St. Paul School say the Pledge of Allegiance in two languages. The second language is Aleut, also known as Unungam Tenu. But here in the world's largest Aleut village, none of the children speak that language fluently.
The youngest fluent speakers are about 75 years old.
Aquilina Lestenkoff works for the tribal government of St. Paul.
I am the director of the Tanaunamakasingin, which would translate into English as the Office of Cultural Affairs.
She's spearheading an effort not to preserve the Aleut language in dictionaries or MP3s, but to bring it back from the brink.
At the beginning of this year, we had 18 fluent speakers, and I think we've lost like 3 or 4. They've passed on. So when you have those types of numbers, you start to chew your fingernails and decide, boy, we really have to make some concerted effort.
A core group of just 4 elders is actively involved in the language revival effort.
And Gregory Freitas is one of them.
I love to talk in Aleut. It's fun.
Here's Gregory Freitas, Sr.
When I want to say something, it doesn't take long. In the English language, it takes a lot of words. But the Aleut language just cuts it out.
Freitas worked with Lestenkoff and other aspiring teachers of Unungam Tenu this summer at the first ever Aleut language intensive program. The aspiring teachers met with elders in small groups. In conversations and skits, they went hunting, as they say, for bits of language from the elders' minds. The goal is to have newly fluent speakers and to have them teaching in the school within 3 years.
It's going to work. We have to make it work. That's our identity of who we are. Your language, your culture, your tradition.
Aquilina Lestenkoff says we need languages to understand places, whether that's a remote island in the Bering Sea or just about anywhere else.
We need to keep them in order to better understand our responsibilities on the whole of the earth.
Words alone can't keep the deep local knowledge of the Pribilof Islands alive, so the tribal government is also helping teach the biology of the islands and how to survive off it. On a calm October morning, a group of middle schoolers joins two hunters on the coastal tundra looking for food. As the sun rises over a flat Bering Sea, hunter Dmitry Zaharov scans the water. The waves are dotted with fur seals, but he's looking for a sea lion.
If you see a bunch of seals that are in one area and they just start to disperse all of a sudden, a lot of times it's a sea lion coming in.
The hunt is part of Bering Sea Days. It's a special week of classes focused on the biology of the Pribilofs, with guest instructors from near and far. Zaharov stands on the tundra just above a rocky point where waves collide from two directions. He says if he can shoot a sea lion close to that point, the waves will wash it ashore.
I yell at them just to get their attention. Start moving around back and forth. Curiosity will get the best of them and they'll come in.
The hunters spot a sea lion and they start to call to it. The Unungan hunters have no luck this morning, but the students learn about marine mammals and they get to spend a school day outside.
I like to learn different things and new things about our island.
Carly Bordakovsky is in eighth grade. She says she helps out when her dad goes hunting.
I know how to tell the difference between a male and a female now. Like their teeth, like their canine teeth, are different from a female and a male.
Greg Freda says he still hunts for his family, even though he just turned 75. And now he helps people hunt for bits of Unungam Tenu, the nearly lost language that he loves.
If I could only bring it back.
That what you just said?
Yes.
If I could only bring it back?
Yeah, I'd be happy.
Reporting from St. Paul Island, I'm John Ryan.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. Like us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Rachel Waldholtz and Lisa Fu in Juneau, Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Ed Schoenfeld in Sitka, Layla Carey in Ketchikan, and John Ryan in St. Paul. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Ron Zastro. Monica Goki is our web editor. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
the Red Dog Mine, committed to environmental excellence.
And by
First National Bank Alaska, where local knowledge and experience make the difference. We believe in Alaska. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC.
And by
Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking rope, chain, and boat anchors from 5 to 3,000 pounds. On the web at arcticwirerope.com. Alaska Pacific University is proud to announce two new bachelor degrees, Alaska Native Governance and Creative and Professional Writing. Learn more at alaskapacific.edu. This message sponsored by APU.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.